This is News from the Peak. I'm Joe Mamlin. Well, we've had a couple of recent episodes, which you should check out if you haven't already, centering around the LCO Good Life Camp. This camp, while an amazing experience on its own, is part of a larger grant that we're working on with the Lakota Ray Tribe in northern Wisconsin. The grant itself is focused on responsible parenting and economic mobility, and the underlying theme of the grant is the idea that teaching young people about their own culture can improve these outcomes for them as they become adults. There's obviously a lot more to it than that, and that's where our guest today comes in. Today we welcome Dr. Nell Weber. Nell is a consultant and researcher with experience in parenting, parental beliefs, early childhood education, literacy, language acquisition, global citizenship, and international education. She earned her doctorate in education from the Harvard Graduate School of Education and now makes her home in Charlottesville, Virginia. We talked to Nell today about her research on parenting both in the U.S. and internationally, and how that background led her to our project. We discussed the impact of culture in parenting and why this is such a key component of the work that the Lakota Ray Tribe is doing with this grant. Nell has been a great person to work with on this project. She's an excellent speaker, and this is an engaging conversation that I think you'll enjoy. We recorded this live at the Lakota Ray Child Support Office in Hayward, Wisconsin, and it was the first time that we actually got to meet Nell in person. As I mentioned, don't forget to check out the other two episodes about the camp. It's going to be a great show, so stick around, and we'll be right back.
So I'm so excited that you're here and talking about the Good Life and your role on the project. And I want to first, before we talk about the Lakota Ray project specifically, just talk a little bit about your background and your research, which is how we found you. We kind of call you a unicorn. You're like, I don't know how we found you, but you're like the perfect fit for this project. And your background and learning about how people develop their parenting beliefs and knowledge, and maybe just talk a little bit about your research and experience in this area.
I did my dissertation research on what American high schoolers know and believe about parenting and child development. And that wasn't my original idea for a dissertation topic. I'm really interested in the parent's role in early learning, and had done prior research on parents' goals and how they see themselves meeting those goals and the way they interact with their children. But I got some funding to do research on adolescence with the idea that eventually this could be a preventative measure to help diminish achievement gaps, early child abuse, by knowing more about what high schoolers know and think, and then maybe designing interventions around giving high schoolers and adolescents more knowledge and trying to, you know, shape their beliefs in ways that are healthy. So I did a pretty big survey of 1,044 American high schoolers to find out kind of just what do they believe? What do they think a parent should do? And how do they learn about the parenting role? And then what do they know about how children learn and grow? And some of the interesting things that I found that is supported by prior research is that the way that high schoolers, and really all people, learn how to be a parent is through three primary means, the most important which is how they were parented themselves. So their experience of being a child and being parented, the things their parents did well, the things that they said, I will never do that. I hated it when my mom did that or my dad did that, and I vow never to do that, although sometimes you eat your words once you become a parent. And their experience caring for younger children, so being in a caregiving role. So I call that kind of the experience realm. They also learn through formal means, although that's probably the smallest. Many states and schools offer parenting units or babysitting classes, or, you know, there's the kind of famous like caring a sack of flour or caring for an egg or a robot baby in some cases activity that a lot of high schoolers do. So those are the three means. So through how they're parented, their experiences caring for younger kids, and then through kind of more formal kind of instruction. And so it was interesting research, and I'm still working with the partner who funded the research and my former advisor to design interventions for high schoolers and implement them and test them. We just did a project, just wrapped up the evaluation of a project in a bunch of schools in Illinois, and it looks good. And that's how you guys found me, is through a little article written about my dissertation research. And it was so exciting to see that, you know, people are finding it and interested, and that I got connected with a project that seems so relevant, especially since I do lots of cross-cultural work in other places.
Yeah, and so our first phone call, I think you were doing a project in Jordan, and so you were talking about this national perspective, and you said that it would be really cool to do a project closer to home. So before I talk about the LCO project, was the project in Jordan kind of the same philosophy or the same topic? Or
similar. So it was a national survey. So we had, how many people? I think like 2,500 parents were surveyed, mostly in person, which is really crazy with COVID. They were doorstep surveys. And the goal was to get a nationally representative sample of Jordanian parents' beliefs and knowledge of early learning. And so we focused on talk, singing, play, kind of math activities, and what else? And reading behaviors. And with the goal of setting a baseline of, you know, this is what Jordanian parents in Jordan, I should say, because we also surveyed lots of Syrian parents.
Okay.
That was a population of particular interest to the government and to the funding organization, and found that, you know, there's a lot of room for improvement, and especially around reading behaviors. But there's a lot of great stuff that's already happening there too. And parents in Jordan love their kids and really want them to succeed in school. So that was a great project that I worked on for a couple years.
So on the Le Coudere project and on the Good Life project, our project was a little different than some of the other sites because we really focused on the cultural aspect. And you have such a great way of describing why the culture component is important to parenting, and I don't know if you can expand a little bit.
Well, when the main source of how you're parented how you think about what it means to be a parent has to do with how you're parented, then of course culture is a huge piece of it. It's family culture, but it's also your community culture. And for this project, one of the things that became really clear to me from the get-go was that strengthening cultural identity was really a linchpin in this project, that is the means through which we're going to build healthier, more responsible parents.
Mm-hmm.
That giving kids a really strong sense of self, giving them pride and comfort in their cultural identity is going to be a protective factor against lots of things that could happen to them, but also going to give them kind of internal resources to be a really good parent.
Because I feel like there's been, and I was probably guilty of this before we were, you know, too far into the project too, but thinking that the cultural aspect was a nice to have. But the more that we've met with you and all of your research and the evaluation team, this is critical. Like, studies show that if kids are connected to the culture, they're more likely to finish school and do all of the things that we want them to do. And like you said, it's a protective factor. So when we're working with you to design this curriculum, how have you, or what's, you know, what was your experience in incorporating all of that culture that none of us come to the table with?
Yeah, well, yeah, as you said, I don't come to the table with it. I'm a cultural outsider, and I am frequently in that role with my other work in other countries. So I have a little bit of practice in, you know, trying to be a good listener and really work collaboratively with local partners mm-hmm. and cultural insiders. But I feel as though, you know, it's just a process that is ongoing. I am trying to put in place strategies like getting interns from the community to help me. But every time I have a meeting with our partners here, our Le Coup d'Orée partners, I feel like I just get so much better information.
Yeah.
And that my mindset is broadened, that I think kind of small and discreet, like this is the learning objective. We're going to learn about, you know, fatherhood, and then we have a conversation with our partners and they say, but we have to think about it differently. And just yesterday we were talking about really the importance of learning in context. Mm-hmm. And often when you're creating curriculum, you're pulling it out of the context. You're putting it on paper.
Right.
Like, here's a lesson plan, you know, this is your script and this is, you know, the resources you need. And I'm trying to rethink how to make sure that all this learning happens in everyday moments mm-hmm. and in context. Is really, when you think about how you're parented, that's really what it is. It's the everyday moments. It's
right,
not like
right.
your parents sitting down and saying,
Lesson one.
Exactly. Here's a list of, you know, now I want you to practice this. But it's, you know, just everyday interactions and everyday moments that are, you know, sitting in the car or going for a walk or eating a meal together.
Yeah, well, a lot of discussions are in the car for sure because they're captive.
Yep.
That's where a lot of learning has taken place. Yeah, so we were talking about this in tech, and maybe expand a little bit on that for the camp. So our experience was we had this curriculum, and actually I still love it, and I don't want to, you know, some of the play and the role-playing kind of stuff I loved. But when we got there, then the kids were in this beautiful location, sitting inside trying to learn language or talking about the play that we were going to do while they looked at the lake, and they just couldn't. But then later we would take hikes and we were swimming and Bonnie would incorporate language. And so that's, is that kind of what you mean by in context?
Yeah. And first of all, I mean, I think that that's such a good example of kind of best laid plans and in good teaching too.
Yes.
You know, you start with your objectives and you know what your objectives are and you have kind of a plan of activities, but sometimes you have to throw your plan of activities out the window because you have opportunities that come up mm-hmm. to meet those objectives in a more natural way. And I think that that's what we're going to try and do with the camp is yes, we have plans for, you know, this storytelling workshop with skits, but, you know, maybe we can meet the same objectives mm-hmm. in a way where the kids aren't taken into a room away from the lake.
Right, right.
And they're on the hike and they're, you know, learning the same, you know, meeting the same learning objectives, getting the same content, but doing it in a way that feels natural and that's in that context and that's fun.
Mm-hmm. So in the original grant application, they talked about the historical trauma in the boarding schools, and you know, as I've been doing research and stuff, it feels like there's this one side of, I don't know if this is too broad, but American society saying that happened a long time ago and it's not relevant today because kids aren't in boarding school today. But can you talk a little bit about why it's still incredibly relevant to, like, this project and what we're doing and where kids are today in this community?
Well, first of all, it really wasn't that long
ago.
I mean, I think the last boarding schools closed in the late 70s, which is parents and grandparents' age. But, you know, I keep mentioning that the way you learn to parent, the key way is through how you were parented. And for generations of Native people, they were taken away from their families and not in that process of getting enculturated into like a parenting culture was disrupted. And so they weren't given the opportunity to learn the traditional ways of parenting, their familial, cultural ways of parenting. And so when and if they did become parents themselves someday, they didn't have the mm-hmm. the resources to do it in a way that made sense. You know, they were kind of at sea. Mm-hmm. And I think we're still feeling those effects today. I think there's also a really deep-seated or deep-rooted and hard to get rid of, I don't know how to put it exactly, damage to this, you know, cultural identity, you know, for the individual to know that this part of them was that was tried to be killed. I mean, mm-hmm. that's really honestly right. was the goal of these programs, to right. kill the Indian.
Right.
And that even today, when, you know, it's not happening in the same overt way. Mm-hmm. I think that that even grants like this, which I think is a wonderful thing, but it's maybe trying to eradicate some Native habits, like even the idea of delaying parenthood versus every child is a gift. I mean, those are two cultural values that are kind of in opposition to one right. another. That an explicit goal of the grant is to delay parenthood until you're ready, whereas there's a deeply held Ojibwe cultural value that in the Lakota community that every child is a gift, mm-hmm. no matter the circumstances mm-hmm. of their birth, and or how old the parents were when the child was born. And so that's a more kind of implicit way of trying to kill an aspect of the Native culture. And kill might be too strong of a word, but I think that some people feel that way.
Yeah. Well, and the more you kind of dig in and understand what one of the first trips to Hayward, we went and learned how to rice, and we got a conversation with an elder, and she was telling us the story about the ribbon skirt and her story, and she was actually featured in one of the Indigidreams as well, but her grandmother had been taken to a boarding school. And so it's not just disruption, like she was in a boarding school and then she got out and then culture came right back. It's this long integrative process where they didn't know the culture to pass on, so there's this, like, disruption almost feels like too loose of a word, because it feels like it was disrupted, but it came back, and it was really just gone.
No, it was eradicated. I mean, it was removed.
Yeah, and so now it's like trying to recreate things that people didn't know. So the coolest part about this camp, honestly, and I talked about it in one of the other podcasts, like, we learned so much, and I felt so grateful that they were so open with us, because we are outsiders, that they were... They loved when we said Miigwech, and we said the blessings at dinner, and that they were so open to it. But it was amazing how few kids actually came in with any cultural, like, how to introduce themselves or how to, you know, some of the traditions. And
No, but I think you're right that for us as outsiders to love and respect the culture enough to join in the practices, I think is really nice and great, especially because I know I feel a little shy about saying Buju,
right,
you know,
right.
because I don't know, is it okay for
I don't
me
want
to say
offend.
That? But I'm also enthusiastic. I want to be an enthusiastic embracer, and that's, you know, in this country, I think we have a bad habit of, you know, if my children learn Spanish and a dual immersion program, everybody's like, that is so great.
Yeah.
But if, you know, a child from Central America who is, you know, bilingual English, Spanish, we see them as kind of a problem. They're like an English language learner in schools.
Right.
And so, in a way, kind of as like white people, like privileging the mm-hmm. language and culture of the Ojibwe, I think, like, I don't want to say elevate it, because it makes it seem like we have all this power, which, I mean, in some ways we do, but it's a sign of respect. It's unfortunate, but exciting that that these kids that haven't necessarily had the opportunity to really engage with their language, that, you know, was in the process of dying out, but hopefully is coming back.
Right.
That they're getting this opportunity, because they say that to be a culture, you need to have a land, a language, and a spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
The land has been almost completely taken away.
Right.
The language has almost died out. The spirituality, I mean, there's like a lot of missionary work that was done to try and also kill the spirituality. And so to bring those three things back, to really give the people back themselves, I think is really exciting.
Yeah, I love how you articulate that. Well, it was really interesting, too, because they were so open. I think that's kind of what I see as just society in general's problem, is that we don't understand each other, so we don't. And we're all, you know, in our own kind of cultural bubble, or I don't know how to say it. But it was neat because they really let, like, the camp counselors were doing the dances, and Becky was teaching the men how to do the fish dance. And when the Lacouture boys saw the Camp Highlands white men doing the fish dance, they got more into it. And I thought, that's what this, like, those were the moments where it was so impactful to see, like, they had a new sense of pride, like, oh, they're interested in our culture. And that made, I don't know, and maybe it was me projecting things on them,
especially with all the negative portrayals of Native people, that, you know, there's, you know, problems with addiction, and there's problems with poverty, and there's you know, yeah, there are negative portrayals, or just only citing all of the ills, you know, and not highlighting all the beautiful parts. I think that does damage to kids, even if they don't realize it.
Yeah, because part of this grant feels a little bit, and no entity in particular, but it feels like maybe because we're only one of the few sites that has a Native American component, that we have to work extra hard to explain why the culture is so important, and that it's not a nice to have. This is absolutely critical to change the trajectory. And so it feels like sometimes we're kind of always trying to explain why the elder voice is really important, because that's not something that you would typically see in a traditional state issued grant, or, you know, like why we have youth at the college, but the youth are not, like, of a certain, you know, they're not youthful in terms of age. And I don't know, we're just, sometimes it feels like we're trying really hard to, like,
justify
it, and also explain it in a way that makes sense but is respectful of the community.
Yeah, I mean, my work in other countries on parenting has shown me that, you know, there are lots of different ways to parent, and it really makes a difference. The culture makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
The language makes a huge difference. One of my first projects out of my master's was a early literacy and numeracy program that I was writing for a big development organization. They were going to use in a whole bunch of different countries, and we wrote a component, a whole series of resources for preschool or like child care centers, and then we decided to add a parenting component. And first of all, I was like, why didn't we start with parents? I mean, preschools don't even exist in so many of these countries, or they're only in the cities, but parents are the people who are teaching, educating their young children. But second of all, the first place I went to go train people on this program was Rwanda, and we had written all these kind of lessons on the components of early literacy, like phonemic awareness, knowing that sounds and letters are connected, and that words are made up of sounds. And I was talking about doing rhyming words, and, you know, the people in there said, in Kinyarwanda, our language, our dominant language, there are no rhyming words. The words do not rhyme, and our words only start with one of three letters. They all start with K or M or, I think, W. But because I didn't know the language, I didn't know that. So all these kind of canonical research on, you know, the building blocks of literacy, language and literacy, did not really apply in the same way.
Because
of the language, and language and culture, you know, are united. And so that's just kind of a concrete example where I came in with all the expert research. But all the expert research is based on what they call weird countries, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, developed. So we had to really rethink a lot of the things we were doing if we wanted to do something that was applicable in lots of different countries. And I still have lots of reservations whenever I do work that's supposed to be applied to lots of different communities because that was really eye-opening in a way that it shouldn't have been at that point in my career, but it was. You really have to understand the local context.
Yeah, but it goes back to one of the things you said on our first call, and you've said so many times, is like just listening and coming with curiosity and trying to, as many times, we all come in with assumptions that we don't even know are assumptions, but just checking ourselves to make sure that we're still listening and listening to understand. And I like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting stuff. I've learned so much from you, and I'm so glad that you're on this project. I really am, and I think, you are a true unicorn, and we're really happy that you're on here. I hope we get to work together a lot.
Me too. This has been great. Well, thank you for bringing me in.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again to Nell for joining us on the show today in a rare live recording of our podcast. And if you haven't already, please check out our two episodes about the Good Life Culture Camp for more context on this project. And we'd love to hear from you and get your ideas and your feedback. And if you'd like to be a guest on the show, please reach out to us on the contact link on our website. News from the Peak is a project of Grace Peak Strategies and is produced by Maureen Life, David Ram, Robert Riddle, and me. You can find the podcast and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, Google Podcasts, Breaker, and Radio Public. You can learn more about us at gracepeakstrategies.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Grace Peak, and we're easy to find on Facebook and LinkedIn as well. This was News from the Peak. I'm Joe Mamlin. Thanks for joining us.
I've never recorded a podcast sitting next to someone because we always do them virtually.
Oh, really?
So I'm like, hi, welcome to the show. It's like SNL when she's there at like the NPR table.
Oh, I love that. Chocolate covered shreddy balls and a little inappropriate, but very sweet.
And she's like, excellent. So how should I start? We don't need to introduce her because you'll do that.
Right, just don't start with how should I start.
Sure. So my dissertation research was on adolescents, American adolescents' beliefs about parenting and child development. Hi, Melinda, how are you?
We're recording.
You're going to have to start them.
Okay, that's fine. They're interviewing me for a podcast, but I'm very happy to see you. No, don't worry.
You wouldn't know.
It's okay.
Oh my god. I'm sorry.
It's been a fun day. Fun 2 days.
I'm so sorry.
You're so sorry. No. You wouldn't know. It's fine.
But I saw the microphone. I could have been like,
no. Oh. We're in the middle. This is like the worst.
We never do it live. It's just kind of exciting.
Yeah, this is the first one I've ever recorded live.
Ooh.
And I'm acting like we're on video, like, hello.
Right. Oh.
I talked more than 15 minutes, but I love all that stuff so much. I think I'm rambling, but I'm totally rambling.